Who'll be arguing today, please?
Ms. Wendy Manning will argue for the appellant. Mr. Steve Hayes will argue for the appellate.
All right, Ms. Manning, finish your water.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is the finality of a settlement agreement. If the trial court's judgment stands, litigants will not be able to truly buy peace by an out-of-court resolution of their dispute. Here we had a compromise settlement agreement that required the execution of a release. The appellees prepared the release. They presented it to the appellants. He executed it. A year later, the appellees filed a motion for non-suit representing to the court that all claims have been fully and finally resolved. After the case was dismissed with prejudice, they're suing for additional performance based on the form of the release that they drafted. Specifically here, the court must decide whether the appellees below conclusively established that appellants breached the CSA. If not, the judgment should be reversed. Appellants filed a cross motion for summary judgment, conclusively establishing that no breach occurred, as well as affirmative defenses, and we ask that the court render for appellants. Alternatively, the trial court abused its discretion in denying the motion for continuance, and so that would be a remand for a full and fair hearing. There are about five key facts, and I'm going to go through them quickly and talk about some of the language that's before the court. The parties entered the compromise settlement agreement to resolve the underlying litigation, and the language is clear. It says the parties desire to enter into a CSA that will dispose of all issues relating to the litigation and the oil, gas, and mineral lease, which is incorporated herein by reference. The language goes on, Moat shall sign a written release of any interest claimed by Moat in the lease. And in exchange for this release, the Gardeners will dismiss the case with prejudice. It contains a merger clause. It contains no express obligation to execute additional documents. And the Gardeners' attorney approved it as to form. The first page of that is in the handout that Mr. Hayes prepared, handout number two. It's just the first page, though. The Gardeners drafted, provided the release. Moat executed it. The motion for non-suit, which is not in the handout, it's clerk's record 96. The Gardeners acknowledge that they have fully and finally settled and compromised all disputes between them and the defendants in this litigation. The order of dismissal follows the same thought through its handout number one. The court, having been fully advised, the defendant acknowledges that plaintiffs are the rightful owners of the interest in question. All matters in controversy have been fully and finally compromised and settled. So there should be no doubt that at the time it was executed, the release was satisfactory to the Gardeners. They accepted it, they dismissed the case in exchange for the release, and on the strength of the release, again containing language that they drafted. The motion for summary judgment below, the appellees failed to conclusively establish that Moat breached the contract. First, there's no contract provision that obligates Moat to execute the release. There's no specific provision. And there's a couple of cases cited in the brief that are really good on this point. One is the Whataburger case. There the franchisee, on the strength of an agreement, wanted the same deal and continuing franchise agreements, and the court said that's not part of the deal. Tenneco is a good case along the same point. Their parties argued in a preferential right context that the right would arise if there was a transfer of property. Well, there was a transfer of control of stock that affected a transfer of property, and the court said you didn't bargain for that. We're not going to apply it into the lease. Another element is that Moat didn't breach the lease. He fully performed what the Gardeners asked him to do. And a really good case on that is this Josky case. And I want to talk about it a little bit.
You said he didn't breach the lease. You meant he didn't breach the release.
I meant the settlement agreement.
That's right. Yes, ma'am. You're not talking about the original lease.
Right. I apologize.
But what about the fact that the settlement agreement specifically says that it applies to both of those parties, Moat and Moat Resources, Inc., and the document defines and refers to both of those, an individual and an entity, as, quote, Moat, close quote.
Right. I'd like to answer that in context of this Josky case.
Okay.
Because I don't think there's any question that had the Gardeners presented a release, that listed both parties, that asked for both signatures, that Moat would have been obligated under the agreement to sign that lease. That's what the language says. But they didn't do that. They're the masters of their own performance they expected from him. And by giving him a release that they now say doesn't release both interests, and actually that's not established either. And this release may or may not release both parties. We don't know that because it wasn't before the trial court. But Jossi was a very similar case. There you had a builder who hired a contractor. And as part of the agreement, the contractor was supposed to execute a bond. And they go on and they talk through some, you know, this person knows that person. This was a long time ago and still in the realm of handshakes, I think. But a gentleman gave a guarantee instead of the bond. And the builders accepted that and said, okay, go ahead and start building this on the strength of this contract. And then later, when they didn't want to abide by the contract, they said, oh, you didn't give us a bond, so no deal. And the court said, it goes through the facts and says that they believe that instrument was admissible as defendant's acceptance of the contract and very bluntly says, who is to blame for it except the defendants? They're the ones that accepted the guarantee and on the strength of that allowed the contractor to proceed to work. And then he goes on and says, even if a bond was a necessary condition to the consummation of the contract, the acceptance by defendants of the guarantee contained in the letter, expressing themselves to plaintiffs as satisfied with it and not requiring a further bond, would meet such condition. So, whatever might be the legal effect of the letter with the guarantee, if the defendants accepted it and took it as sufficient bond, declaring they were satisfied with it, when they could have obtained a more complete guarantee, they should not be heard to say that it was not what was required. And that's the same situation we have here.
Is your position that counsel for Mr. Moat did prepare the settlement agreement draft?
Yes.
And that when you were talking about a settlement agreement, the parties to the litigation were the Gardners and Mr. Moat individually.
The parties to the litigation?
Yes.
The release does, though.
No.
Okay,
I'm just
ahead.
Asking you about the parties to the litigation, not
okay.
What the release goes on to. The only parties are individuals, right?
Yes.
And then counsel for Mr. Moat prepares this first paragraph in the settlement agreement.
Yes.
And adds a reference to Mr. Moat being president of Moat Resources, Inc.
Whether that's specific what was added, I'm not sure. But yes, counsel for Moat drafted the CSA as it was executed. It was, of course, approved as to form by the Gardeners.
And I read in the briefs that the explanation for why he put that in there. And I'm not sure where this came from, whether it's not by affidavit or where, but that there was a reference in the briefs, at least, that the reason that Moat Resources, Inc. were added is because Mr. Moat individually had made a partial assignment to Moat Resources, Inc. of some of the legal rights that were granted by the original lease agreement.
There is a suggestion as to that in the record. It's not very well developed. So I'm not, I wasn't there, but what I do know is that, yes, the Moats Council drafted the CSA. It was approved as to form by the Gardeners. Everybody was aware of that situation when this document was executed.
Were they aware of the situation that there was an assignment of a portion of the legal rights?
Of whatever that situation is. Whether there's an assignment or not, I don't know. I know that is in an affidavit that they had that conversation. I'm not sure what the legal status of the title
is. Must there have been, on the part of Mr. Moat, an intention to make a full release of all benefits that he gained by being the lessee in the original lease?
I'm glad you asked that. It says that what he desires is to enter into a compromise settlement agreement that will dispose of all issues relating to the litigation and to the lease, which is incorporated herein by reference. And I think that's the best statement of the party's intention that we're going to find.
What about that there, that in the cause number that they're seeking to dismiss with prejudice and shall not seek any other damages cause of action against Moat incident to the operation of the original lease? Well, wasn't it incident to the operation of the original lease that he made an assignment of a portion of his legal rights under that lease? I'm trying to figure out.
I do, and I'm trying to understand your question.
I apologize. What I'm trying to figure out is this. These parties were in a that were in agreement enough to sign a lease for the premises. Then they had a falling out because it wasn't development. During the time that the development was supposed to have been occurring, and a transfer of a part of those interests was made by Mr. Moat to this corporation that he's president of. And then you have litigation in which Mr. Moat's individually named because he's individually the party on the lease. And then you have a settlement, and his lawyer voluntarily adds Moat Resources, Inc. to the definition of Moat. Now, if it appears to me that if the settlement agreement itself is filed of record and attached to the original release, it probably that would be an adequate understanding that anybody examining the title might look at and at least come to a surmise, reasonable, that the signature by Mr. Moat on that release that he did sign was adequate to cover all of his interest. And maybe he didn't have to have a separate line that said, Moat Resources, Inc., by Mr. Philip Moat, president.
And I think that's a very good possibility. That was not before the trial court. We don't know. The trial court hasn't looked at the release. The trial court hasn't found whether it releases both parties or not, which is part of the reason we're here. The issue is, does he have to sign this other release?
All right. So to the bottom line, or for my line of questioning, and I'm trying to talk to you about, is what is it that is a benefit to Moat Resources, Inc.? What benefit do they have that they want to keep by not signing another partial release?
Okay. This is a great question. This is the kind of dispute I deal with in my kitchen every morning at breakfast. I know you want to use the blue plate, but your brother wants to use the blue plate. Use the green plate. It'd be easier for everybody if you just use the green plate and quit arguing about it. But those are not the kinds of disputes that courts answer. Courts answer who's obligated to use the blue plate, who's obligated to use the green plate. Courts don't want to get in the business of dealing with the kind of issues I deal with around my breakfast table, and that's what this is. Why didn't he just sign it and let's all go home? I don't know. My belief, and I think it's a fair inference from the record, is that these people hassled him, they sued him, we settled. What he bought was peace, and what he's got is another lawsuit, and he's just done. If he doesn't have to sign it, he doesn't want to.
Thank you.
And that kind of goes along with the second element. There is no evidence here that there was a breach. A big one here is there's no evidence that there was injury. And this goes back to the trial court not being asked to construe the release versus the partial release. There's no evidence that there's any difference to the gardeners between the partial release and the release, or that Pioneer wouldn't have gone ahead and drilled even without, or that some other entity wouldn't have gone ahead and drilled without it. We have no evidence of the fact of injury here. There is an assertion in an affidavit that says everything in the motion for summary judgment is true and correct, and we all know there's a litany of cases that say for the same reason you can't use a pleading, even a sworn pleading, as summary judgment evidence, you can't incorporate the swearing of a pleading into a separate document and call it summary judgment evidence either. I'd like to spend just a minute on the motion for continuance. The law, and it's just a lot of it cited in the brief, is that litigants have a fundamental right to be represented in court. I think it was an abuse of discretion not to allow the hearing to be postponed so that counsel of record for Moat could be there. And I signed that affidavit not as counsel. I was doing a buddy a favor the week before Christmas and walking a motion through. It's a courtesy to the court. I'm now appellate counsel, but I was not counsel. I had no authority to represent Moat at the time. The argument basically is that it would have been futile, that even if counsel had been there, it wouldn't have made a difference because no response was filed. Again, same argument we're making here. The move-in has to conclusively establish his cause of action. That did not occur here.
And the motion was just filed. It was never pursued, actually.
It was pursued, and I think even the appellees recognized that at the time, at the motion for summary judgment hearing, that the judge said, I don't want to hear the motion for continuance. I want to hear the motion for summary judgment. So it was before him, and he could consider it. It was raised again in a motion for reconsideration. And there's the second reporter's record is that hearing. The motion for reconsideration is a motion for reconsideration of the motion for continuance. It also includes the appellant's affirmative motion for summary judgment, both that it's conclusively established there was no breach and on the affirmative defenses. So whatever happened in the first hearing, it was before the court the second time. And one other thing I wanted to mention along that line, there's an allegation in the brief that the motion was not timely filed. Again, we had a motion for partial summary judgment granted, and then in the motion for reconsideration, appellants moved for affirmative summary judgment across motion. The cases in the brief that are cited in response are either a motion for summary judgment filed after a final judgment or a request for rendition when there was no cross motion filed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Manning. Mr. Hayes.
Excuse me. May it please the court, Ms. Manning. My name is Steve Hayes. I represent the Gardners in this case. The appellant's reply has presented some situations we need to respond to. They've raised some new points, we think, and we want to provide the court with some additional authority. I'll try to get through these as quickly as I can because I know you've got some other questions. With regard to their argument about the one final judgment rule, we have provided you some general authority that objections under Rule 301 have to be raised at the trial court or they are waived. They've chided us because we didn't provide you with any authority that a one final judgment rule had to be, complaint had to be asserted there. There is such a case, Marin, M-A-R-I-N, Real Estate Partners versus Vogt, V-O-G-T, 373 Southwest 3rd 57 at pages 92, 93, that says the one final judgment rule complaint has to be raised at the trial court or it's waived. They did not raise that point at the trial court and waived it. With regard to their complaints about the affidavit incorporating or referring to facts in the motion for summary judgment is true and correct. The litany on that or the history on that is in their original brief they said there was no evidence of such facts. They provided no authority for their argument. We pointed out in our response that yes, as far as any of the facts stated, but as far as Pioneer's title opinion showing the need for a corrected release, we pointed out that there was an affidavit which specifically said that those facts were true and correct. Then in their reply brief, they said, well, an affidavit cannot incorporate such facts by reference. And for the first time, they cited two cases, the Dufford case and the Loomis case, one of which was decided in 1960, one of which was decided in 1961. Both of those cases were decided before Rule 166AF added the provision that said that defects in the form of affidavits will not be ground for reversal unless pointed out by objection with opportunity but refusal to amend. So there's that. Secondly, also there is a case that has specifically held that any complaint about the form of the affidavit to the effect that it incorporated facts by reference must be raised at trial or it's waived. That particular case is Lawrenson, L-A-W-R-E-N-S-O-N, versus Global Marine, 869 Southwest 15, jump site page 523. Because they failed to provide any such authority in their original brief, we would also take the position that they have failed to brief that appropriately. That's this court's opinion in Gordon versus Brunig, B-R-U-N-I-G, 2010 Tex App Lexus 3774. They have not objected to the statement as being either hearsay or conclusory. We would note that it is not conclusory, it just states facts. As far as it being hearsay, that's another objection they would have had to raise at the trial court or waive. They did not raise that objection.
Mr. Hayes, what was the site on the 69 Southwest 520 something? What's on the Lawrenson case? You said, what's the site on that again? I didn't get a copy.
Yeah, the Lawrenson case is 869 Southwest 2nd, 519, jump site 523.
Okay, thank you.
With regard to the hearsay objection having to be raised at trial court, that's this court's opinion in Law Office of David E. Williams, the 2nd PC versus Fort Worth Press. I would like to deal for a moment as well, and this is the final section in the handout I have given you. It's a little table that I put together. They have raised the point, about that sort of the argument is, well, Philip Moat has signed a release. It's done all that he has to do. He doesn't have to do any more. First of all, we'd point out, and this is not on the handout, the compromise settlement agreement did not say you have to sign a particular specific release. It said that Philip Moat and MRI had to release all of their interest in the lease except as to 80 acres. It didn't define the release that had to be signed. What's interesting, though, is, and as you follow along in the table, we've pointed this out in our brief. We've pointed out the fact that the first release, if Philip Moat is going to take hyper-technical interpretations of documents, which he's obviously going to take because he's done so in this case, he would look at that first release and say, well, this says that the undersigned, which was Philip Moat, does hereby relinquish to the hereinafter named lessors. And then the release doesn't name anybody as a lessor thereafter. So he would take the position, I haven't released anybody from anything. When you look at the release that Pioneer requests, and this is the second column over here, the way that the Pioneer release fixes that for Philip Moat, is it says that the current lessees, and it defines that to be Mr. Moat and MRI, relinquished to the present owners of the mineral estate. So it fixes it. It makes sure that he can't get out on that hyper-technical interpretation of the first release. The second thing is when you look at what, and this is the third line in the table, when you look at the property that the compromise settlement agreement said was being released or the interest that was being released, it says that Mr. Moat and MRI were releasing any interest claimed in the Yates lease except to 80 acres. In other words, you're releasing it all except as to part. When you look at the original release, that's not what was released necessarily. What was released is it says the undersigned is hereby relinquish any interest to the lands described below insofar as that covers 404 acres described in the attached Exhibit B. In other words, you're only releasing so much. And whether there's an identity between what was released, save and except, and what was released insofar as this, we can't know and we don't know. What we do know is that the undisputed summary judgment evidence is that Pioneer had a title opinion done and Pioneer's lawyer requested the corrected release to clear title. And the way the Pioneer release deals with this issue is it tracks the language in the compromise settlement agreement by saying current lessees relinquish all of the current lessees' rights in the lease, save and except the 80 acres. In other words, it tracks the compromise settlement agreement. MRI has signed nothing and given up nothing. So that's the reason with regard to Mr. Moat, the additional release is necessary to bring him in compliance with what he promised to do in the compromise settlement agreement. I want to move on for just a second. They've made a point on the attorney's fees. I think we've covered this in our briefs, but just to be sure, one of the things they have chided us on is that, well, you know, you've brought a deck action, you've got some relief under the deck action, you shouldn't be able to recover attorney's fees, and they've cited cases dealing with other things. Those cases all have to do with situations where the primary claim, the underlying claim that was really asserted in the first instance, you could not recover attorney's fees on. And then people were using the deck action to bootstrap themselves into the position of recovering their attorney's fees. That's not the case in this situation. We brought this suit, the Gardners brought this suit, for an interpretation and an enforcement of the compromise settlement agreement, a contract. Under Chapter 38, They're entitled to recover their attorney's fees pursuant to that contract, just because it's a contract and because they're suing for a breach and enforcement of it. But the contract itself specifically provided that the prevailing party is entitled to recover its fees. So that's the general thrust of that. And the declaratory judgment action, to the extent that it gives them the right to recover fees, doesn't give them a chance. It's not allowing them to do something they couldn't otherwise ordinarily do. To the extent they're trying to make some implied argument now about the fact that, well, there's some aspects of the DEC action that maybe aren't related or aren't based on a breach of contract, if they're talking about a segregation of fees issue, they've waived that because they didn't bring that up at the trial court. As a matter of fact, they didn't complain about the amount of the fees at all, and they conceded the amount of the fees. So if they were going to talk about segregation of fees, if that's what their argument is now, they waived it. That's the Green International versus Solis case out of the Supreme Court that's in our brief, I believe. The cross motion for summary judgment, we've already talked about in our brief. It was never heard. It was waived. They just didn't bring it up at the hearing and didn't even pursue it. We've talked about in our brief why their affirmative defenses fail. They fail to present any evidence in support of them. On the motion for continuance, Justice Gabriel, you're right. It was never set for a hearing, period. There's no setting on that. And that the court then didn't hear it, either refused to hear it or whatever, it wasn't ripe for hearing in that it had never been set. there's no record made of the proceeding. This court is obliged, I think, in that situation to assume that whatever happened at that hearing supports the order or the decisions or the failure to rule of the trial court, whatever those may be. So that's the deal on that.
What about the motion for reconsideration?
The motion for reconsideration was filed, was set for hearing, and was heard. It's judged by an abuse of discretion standpoint. It's our position that the trial court did not abuse its discretion if it had heard the motion for continuance. It did not abuse its discretion for all the reasons we've set out in our brief. This case had been pending for a while. The lawyers had known about the summary judgment hearing for a month. They had time to have a lawyer there to observe what was going on. They knew of the conflict for at least a month. You're not entitled to an oral hearing on a motion for summary judgment. No evidence was taken. We've distinguished their cases in our brief. They've tried to distinguish the cases we've relied on in their reply, but when you go through and look at the distinctions they draw on our cases, and I probably don't have time to go through all those right now, the distinctions they draw are on points in those cases that we don't cite the cases for. We feel like we're in good shape there, quite frankly.
I have an ancillary question. It kind of goes back to more to the beginning, relating to the settlement agreement. The recital recites, obviously, a different cause number, 9-1-59 in the 271st. So Moat and Moat Resources, Inc., were parties to that original lawsuit?
No. Philip Moat was.
Okay.
Moat Resources was not a party to that lawsuit. And that's the point that Justice Myers was bringing out, that Philip Moat's counsel asked that Moat Resources be joined to the compromise settlement agreement, but they were never added to the lawsuit. Okay. Up to and including the point of dismissal. Interestingly, on the order of dismissal, and we've pointed this out in our brief, that the order of dismissal was on file with the trial court in this case. It's probably an order that the trial court could have taken judicial notice of since it occurred in its courtroom in the prior case. But it was filed with the, I believe, the motion for summary judgment that Moat and Moat Resources filed. Interestingly, in going back over the record, I found that order of dismissal, and this is actually the reason I put this behind tab one in the handout, and there's the little red arrow down in the bottom corner. Philip Moat and Moat Resources actually filed this order of record with the court with their original answer in this case. So this order of dismissal was on file with the court when we filed our motion for summary judgment. It was on file with the court in this case when they filed their motion for continuance. In the partial summary judgment order that the court signed in our behalf, the court specifically mentioned that it examined all the pleadings filed with it at that time, meaning that this is something it took into consideration, at least with regard to the summary judgment, but it was in front of it when the motion for continuance was heard, reminding it that, you know, Philip Moat had conceded once before that my clients owned the mineral interest and that this case had been disposed of before. Unfortunately, what's going on here is somebody, in my opinion, is holding out for more money, and that's fine. We understand that goes on all the time. But in the compromise settlement agreement, both Philip Moat and Moat Resources agreed to release any interest they held in the Yates lease. And they arguably have not done that. And the one company that wants to do business with my clients is saying, here's the release we need and we want and we have to have. And they simply.
Judge, may I extend just a moment? I want to ask a brief question. Mr. Hayes, from your review of the record in this case, is there any evidence of any present activity on this 484 acres? I know there's 80 of it.
80's gone, yeah.
Is there any evidence of any activity relating to the 404 acres on the part of the corporation, Moat Resources, Inc.? Any evidence in the record anywhere about anything that Moat Resources, Inc. is doing on this leased property?
Right now?
However, in the whole time from whenever you first had the first lawsuit filed until the final was entered in this particular case, is there any evidence of any activity on this lease by Moat Resources, Inc.?
That's something I've never really thought about. I'm not aware of anything in this record that shows that Moat Resources had any activity on this 404 acres. I think what I'm going to say is true. I think all the evidence in the case is to the contrary, that it didn't have any activity, because that was the first lawsuit. There has been no activity, therefore cancel the lease through non-production. Of course, that lawsuit was against Philip Moat, and that's when my client still thought that Philip Moat, as I understand it, owned the lease. I mean, he was the lessee.
All ownership interest under the lease were being held for the benefit of or being utilized as a legal matter by Mr. Moat individually, but he, in fact, had assigned, or at least it's alleged that he had made some assignment of some part of that a bundle of property rights to Moat Resources, Inc.
That's what I understand. We weren't aware of that when we filed the first lawsuit, and then it came out when it came time to settle the first lawsuit. But the point was that there had been no production under the lease, and that's the first lawsuit.
Is the title report, in terms of the research done by Pioneer, is that a part of the record of this case?
It is not.
I didn't see it.
No, sir. It's not in there.
Just for my habit of reading those kind of things.
The only thing that we have that I know of is the statement that we've put in our brief that Pioneer had a title opinion issued and its lawyer insisted on a new lease to clear the title.
Thank you for letting me ask those questions, judges.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Ms. Manning, rebuttal.
May it please the court. I wanted to start with one of the last comments that counsel made, and that is in this order of dismissal. There's been an allegation that appellants conceded knowledge. I want to read that whole statement rather than just what's highlighted in the handout. It says, the court, having been fully advised, the defendant acknowledges that plaintiffs are the rightful owners of the mineral interest in question. He's going to dismiss the case. The record is that this order was drafted by the gardener. So the gardeners advised the court of that. There's no approval as to form. I mean, Moat never signed off on that statement at all. So I think that's important. Again, another thing there's not any evidence in the record of is that he's holding out for more money. I'm honestly not sure it would matter at this point what he's done because he's fully complied. The one final judgment rule, we did object. Appellants objected. They filed an objection to the proposed to the judgment and put another proposed judgment in, of course, not waiving the right to appeal. So that is in the record. There's an allegation that by raising the objection to the affidavit attached to summary judgment in the reply, we've waived it. It was raised in the response. The reply directly argues at that point in the response. It wasn't an issue initially. And this is very significant. There was no objection to form as in trial court. Why was there no objection as to form in the trial court? Because counsel wasn't there. Because counsel found another solo attorney to walk a motion for continuance through so that he could participate in a trial verified by the trial judge at the same time. I mean, all of the questions about what should have been raised, they should have been raised, but counsel should have had an opportunity to raise them. And again, I want to point the court back.
That's not what a hearing for motion for summary judgment is about. You don't make objections. You don't offer evidence, make objections.
I understand, and maybe I misspoke. The motion for continuance was filed several days before that hearing.
But it was never set for a hearing.
It was heard.
He said he didn't want to hear it, or at least that's what you told me the
right.
judge said.
He said he did not want to hear it. He would hear the motion for summary judgment. But because the nature of a motion for continuance is don't hear the motion for summary judgment today because counsel's not here, he implicitly overruled that motion. And there's
a lot
of... Do
you have any authority that implicitly overrules?
I do, actually. I have to send it to you in a letter, but I do have it. Can I submit that?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. I'm going to move on then. On this handout as far as the injury, this was not raised in the trial court at all. And it's not really raised here. The appellees make a statement that... that, of course, that's an injury because they'd like to do something with their land that it looks like they're not going to be able to do, but that's not evidence. It was never heard in the trial court. So this I don't think is properly before the court. There is no evidence of injury, that the parties would be in a different position below if Moat signed the partial release. The statement was made that the release that had to be signed was one that did something different. But again, the Joski case, the surety, the bond, the guarantee, if the party said, this is satisfactory to me, it doesn't matter what the legal effect of that turns out to be. That's a bargain for exchange, and we leave the parties to the bargain that they made. The release does release both parties. It speaks to Moat as MRI and Moat. So whether MRI was a party below in the first case, I don't think is as significant. And I want to mention very quickly the affirmative defenses. This is a classic waiver and estoppel case. Did they have the right to have a release that was broader that said something different? Maybe. But they presented a release, they drafted it, they accepted it, they dismissed the case on the strength of it. That is as classic an intentional relinquishment of a known right as I can think of. And the same thing with estoppel. They represented to Mr. Moat, sign this release and we'll be done. We're going to resolve all disputes between us. That's the language in the CSA. And instead, he did what they asked him to do, and we've got another lawsuit. So again, a classic case of estoppel as well.
Well, he says the CSA doesn't say sign this release. It says release any right or claim you have.
I'm going to look back at the language. It says, Moat shall sign a written release of any interest claimed by Moat.
Okay, but it didn't say this release.
No, but it becomes this release because it's the lease that they drafted and insisted on him executing in exchange for dismissal of the lawsuit. That's appellant's position. And that's, unless you've got questions, that's all I have.
All right, thank you. Appellant will have 10 days to file a post-submission letter brief. And then after that's filed, appellees may file any response within 10 days of that without any further motion for leave to file being required. We appreciate all of your arguments and your extensive and thorough briefing for this case today. We appreciate your arguments and being here today as well and working with us on rescheduling the case as well. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. And that concludes court for today, so we will be adjourned.